Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
How far can you go when you've studied Latin at school for just 1.5 or 2 years? Well, the answer is, I found, a surprisingly deep amount. It's sort of strange to say so. 1.5 years or 2 years of Latin wasn't all that much. I sort of learned the actual structure of Latin, if you decline your vocabs, if you, the overall structure of Latin, and I didn't think it would actually come in that much handy, but it sort of has. It sort of has given me a behind the scenes look at some points in history and some of the thinking and some of the limitations and some of the works. So obviously I'll mention the fact that Newton and Descartes, when they wrote in Latin, and it's interesting to actually read some of their Latin, and with the help of Google Translate, which obviously I would have to have, because unfortunately my Latin, the number of vocab that I have, or the declension that I have, is limited. And the question is, you know, why there's that, and there's sort of some ancient Livy, the Latin text of Livy, and odd little things like letters to Lyticus, or Atticus, letters to Atticus. There's odd little bits of Latin that you read, and it sort of gives you a lot of insight, strangely, a lot of insight of reading the original Latin and seeing how people have translated it into a modern language. And it gives a sort of deceptive feeling, actually, reading the modern the Latin. So just for a simple view, sort of reading back in Roman times, there was no multiplication, or there may have been a multiplication, but looking at the, say, Newton, he would say such and such a variable is conjunct. His term for multiplication is conjunct. And he actually, there are actually no equations, or I can't remember reading any equations in Newton. It's all written longhand with some Latin, and it's a bit hard to get across. So you read the actual English translation of some of his works, and then you go back and you realise that they've made his work understandable by actually, for when he says conjunct, which has got sort of Latin meaning and Latin overviews, and they've put a narrow meaning of it, of times, and of course that's what he was meaning, but you realise that Newton was struggling. Latin was actually forming some of the words coming across, some of the words coming across, or some of the ways things were structured. He used the word massa, which was developed again, tracking back. Giles of Rome developed the word mass, and that comes from the Latin, the idea of dough, the actual physical stuff, dough. And so learning the Latin roots allows you to track words back, and how mass arrived as the eye of dough. It wasn't never used as mass in ancient times. It was only used as a sort of bread dough, and this idea came in the 8th or 9th century by Giles of Rome, who was trying to wrestle with the fact of even more ancient scripts, that's Aristotle and the Bible, putting it together and trying to work out what the whether it was in fact a heresy. This is the major thing of scholasticism, is actually the scholasticism were trying to know the mind of God, but also divine, whether new material was heretical or a contribution. So there was a view there, and he was trying to work out whether the transubstantiation of the bread and the wine into the body and blood, how that fit, how could that actually happen. And so working through this, he came up with the idea of matter, It's something which is conserved, even though the, sorry, not matter, mass, even though the matter was different. So obviously, it's all very, very confused, but Newton struggled with what mass was, and of course, we never really understood, I suppose, up until even just a couple of years ago, knowing about the Higgs boson and stuff like that. So these people were stabbing it in the dark, trying to actually connect things together and saying, look, it must be this, it must be that. And Newton came back. And as I said, I might as well stick with Newton. I'll actually go on a few other little schoolboy stuff. So essentially, look, I've got really basic Latin, and I get a hunch, and then you can actually just paste the Latin into your browser. I think it can actually recognize that it's Latin, and it'll automatically provide a translation for it. Now, obviously, if you've got an idea of the origin of some of the words, you can see how it's translated or what things mean, like the conjunct and the place in and the way that things are put. So actually, no, the actual thing, the actual words, is like actually being there, whereas as opposed to watching a telly movie of it. So it's sort of like the difference between watching an operation on a heart operation on TV, where there's all the drama, the shots are set up from you, as opposed to actually being a participant in the heart operation. It's obviously not that. It's somewhere in between, where you're sort of behind the curtain and you can hear the conversations going on and trying to work out what's going on here. So there's lots of interesting things about the actual real translation of Newton, and trying to understand the limitations and some of the conclusions people draw. Like, they write Newton's equations, they don't realize that Newton had didn't have the facility of equations that was really developed by Descartes, who started to develop this symbology of what we would recognize as a modern equation. So it's almost as though there's, you know, how we recognize a huge difference between Roman numerals and Arabic numerals. Basically, conceptually, before the ideas were still stuck in that Roman numeral viewpoint. They weren't stuck together in a very obvious equation. So things were very well hidden, and Newton was able to actually reduce things. So something which we would write down as the inverse square law would take not Newton would, oh, it's really hard to see really the actual text where Newton talked about it, but the inverse square law was one of the discoveries of Newton, or as far as the eye can read. And namely, you really get an insight into what Newton is by reading other books in other languages, in French and in English, which explain Newton, and they go into great depth. And because they don't have equations, still don't have equations, or they're telling an audience who don't understand equations, who see the way that they describe in great depths with heaps and heaps of different examples. The commentary at the time, the actual understanding of the Latin, the limitations of the Latin, and I suppose some of the modern simplifications of what Newton wrote. And as you read the read through Descartes and read through Principalia, you realize that Newton is very, very influenced by Descartes, and there's almost a disdain for René Descartes. Who is René Descartes? So he's a French philosopher. He has seen the trouble you get into if you go against the state or if you go against the church. So he really developed a theory of mind. So he said that modern schooling was a parody of reason. And he said the theory, the schooling of the mind, you had to self-teach yourself, schooling of the mind. I think that's what the actual word was. And so Descartes was very much a belief in God, and he came up with the X and Y, the Cartesian coordinates. which I look, I've read through Newton. I may be proven wrong, but I can't see too much of that Descartes stuff. And so Descartes formulated three theories of motion, and he look, I can't really remember I can remember reading, I can picture in my head some of the diagrams he drew associated with these three theories of motions. I think one was to do, he had sort of a mix up with torque there, and he had a method of explaining motion, which was a mechanistic mechanism, which involved vortexes and more ancient views of force going in and out. And of course, the irony is that he's actually very close to it. If you look at the Higgs boson and symmetry breaking and exchanges with it, so in effect, the work of Higgs, the Higgs boson, describes matter, the motion. Oh, so we have matter as a hypercharge. And look, I must admit, I've got to reread into it because this is all new stuff, and there's certain stuff which, you know, actually hurts to read. There's one thing that there's a different hypercharge for different spins of electron. I find that just mind bending. You know, what the heck is going on there? And I can sort of see how you can have different symmetries, which you can have that, but there's a lot to understand. But in effect, the Higgs space is affecting that matter moves continuously because it's actually superconducting. It's effectively a superconductor in the Higgs field, which just goes throughout the universe, which is a scalar field. So it's interesting that a lot of the insights that Descartes have really, you know, if Einstein and other things and eventually the Higgs is a step away from Newton, it's actually a step closer to what Descartes said. Now, when you say this and speak to the average person, no one has actually read back into the detail of what Descartes said. And you might say, well, why have I done it? I don't know. I just found it interesting to read. And you go, oh, let's read that and just sort of try and understand it. And so Newton also had his three laws. And you could say, is there really necessary a first and second law? Like the first law is a special case of the second law, if you want to go across it. It is necessary because that special case of the first law really goes against the Aristotelian view that you put motion or inertia, the inertia force, into an object, and that object will move, but it wants to cut, its natural state is staying at rest. Of course, this is not what the first law says. So the first law is more a historical footnote to sort of break us free from the Aristotle's view, but we no longer have the Aristotle's view, so it's a bit of a strange thing. Of course, you can read all of this as you read through Newton, and this is where having the basic schoolboy Latin. And so, look, I should do an aside on how I fared with Latin, so that was hard, but before we go into it, you read through huge tracts of Newton where he describes putting different masses in a box on a string to sort of show that pendulums, the oscillation of a pendulum is independent of the actual nature of the actual mass, whether it's brass or copper, and which is hard to do, but he's, I don't think he referred to Descartes, but he does a lot of work in there, working against Descartes or disproving in his mind Descartes. So he describes these experiments. And if you read it as a modern science teacher, as a lab report, you'd say, look, this is a flawed experiment. You know, this person's trying to find this out by a string in a box. And if you read through it, a lot of it sounds quite flawed and poorly expressed if you read it in the ancient Latin. And of course, they actually say, well, let's track through what, you know, when did Newton define mass? Well, he actually defined mass as what happened is he basically had the density equation. So if you have a dense object and a small volume, that will have the same property as a less dense object in a big volume. So you read a lot of this circular stuff, and it's written in Latin. It's hard to go. And as I promised, I'd get back to my experience in Latin. So I'm a classic uber dyslexic person. So I didn't speak till I was 8 years old, and I got the D's and the B's mixed up with the sixes and the nines mixed up, the less than and greater than mixed up, and just really, really struggled at the bottom of the class. Wasn't really the bottom of the class. I suppose it was the bottom of the class, grade 3, grade 1, grade 2. No one could understand me, so that was good, except for a few people. And it was quite educational not to be understood and have people in the room know that I couldn't be understood, and then they would say things and then act completely differently when another person came into the room because they assume that you couldn't. I couldn't understand. Of course, I think by suddenly in 6th grade or 7th grade, a lot of the problems cleared up, and I suddenly was able to do maths and science, and you know, slowly the other subjects picked up. But not in time for when I hit Latin. And of course, Latin and French just killed me with all the declensions. It's like a word with a different ending on was sort of like a nightmare for me. But I really struggled to do Latin for 1 year. The second year is, no matter how hard I tried, I always got 56%. I sort of know that I got 56%. And it's just was inflexible. Like, I used to study really, really, really hard, and I'd still get 56%. And so I sort of, I really have to drop this. I didn't, I think I did 2 full years of, I didn't do it the next year. I really didn't want to do it. It's too hard to me. Of course, I was in the second highest stream. I think there was 7 grades. At this Jesuit school, it was interesting. The Jesuit school also was Latin. Sort of went back to religious Latin, so you could read and start to understand things like that. The highest level group did French, Latin, and Greek. Sort of a brainstorming thing, and that was, I think, it was Greek only started in year 8, and so I think I did year 8 Latin all the way through, but really, really suffered. And I got 56. Every test, no matter what I did. And years later, they said, oh, look, this particular teacher was kicked out of the school for X number of reasons. And, you know, there's certain things you can do in a Catholic school which gets you kicked out automatically. But one of them was that he never bothered to mark any tests. He just gave a student a certain mark. I only heard that sort of when I was 25 or something like that. Did you hear such and such? A teacher left under such a physical, and this was just a footnote, and it just went boing. And so, sort of nowadays, I read, like when I'm really researching something, you read Principalia, and you say, just read the English translation. You say, look, somehow I'm happy with that. How Green said in Latin, and you go back to the Latin and read it, and then you see all these passages that they haven't bothered to translate. Or haven't bothered up. And look, there's other things, reading the original text. A lot of the texts, like Newton's stuff, had a lot of the texts at the time had poems at the start of it. So, yeah, going back and reading the original texts give a lot. And of course, if you read Descartes and Newton, you see these two people fighting. So that was the popular thing of the time. It was establishing another school, and you can just sort of read all other things. The essential stuff is understanding theology, and Newton is an important thing. So Newton was believing he was uncovering the laws of God. So God would look at the mass of one object and the mass of another, and God would then actually be the source of the power between the two objects. So the Newton's law is universal law of gravitation is a religious statement of forces. It's not an explanation of gravity. It's a description of gravity. That had to come later, and of course, if it's not an explanation, what was the explanation? Well, the explanation was, if you read into it, the attributes and description of God, it was uncovering how God operates the thing. So there's still the idea of this guy out there saying, well, I'm going to actually keep on pushing Earth in a circular orbit. You know, there's the hand of God, everything, the hand of creation. And we're just looking for the eye of the creator. And it's a very religious text, and it's very interesting that the religious text and the religious methodology is still used in the actual teaching of modern Newton, and not moving forward. Look, there's a few other texts, reading Latin texts going back. Look, there's some texts which you say are very important, and you go back and read them. It's Letters to Atticus is one text which just absolutely amazes me, because you've got the original translations. It's not necessarily Latin. I think I've read it in English one. I really can't remember which one I did there. But this seemingly inane text, like, it was definitely inane. If such and such weather happens, do this. Tell the servants to lock all the doors and answer so and so's letter and things like that. And this is rigorously written down as a text which is held across, and they are the letters. So there's a lot of texts which, when you read it, you have to be a super scholar to work out what is so important about it. And then we tend to read excerpts from texts. It's sort of like the difference between, well, obviously you can't get back and play an AFL footy match back then, so many 100 years ago. But it's sort of like they show the season highlights, the best kicks out of it, the best plays in a 5-minute capsule. But there's nothing like actually sitting on a game and you watch them warming up. You watch bad plays, good plays, boring plays, and the spectacular plays. And this is so true for different texts. And if you know so much, you read a certain amount, and there's certain texts which just are very insightful, jaw-dropping. One of the things I did read is Livy, and I think it was an English translation, but also there's the original Latin. And there's something that we sort of tend to have modern eyes on it and avoid other stuff, but he would, and this is all the way through, all throughout the ancient world, they would describe their banks and signs were together. So there was a sign where a lamb cub fell out of an eagle's grip or something like that had great portent. And you really read into it and you'd say, these guys, they're not superstitious as we would, as a relative thing. Superstition was the absolute currency of thought for these guys. If you read through it, there was a very interesting thing that Augustus went up to have his lose two legions in Germany, and Livy wrote that no one is going to go across the Rhine because when they suggested a poltergeist, Augustus appeared as a poltergeist and began to throw things at someone. And so this convinced them. So a lot of the thought, Roman thought, was of religious superstitious value. And you sort of think back, well, obviously if I didn't like something, I would just throw a cup at someone and said, you know, what's happening? Oh, well, that was an emperor's a poltergeist. And it's interesting if you read the ancient Latin to see what ideas were missing. So a lot of our ideas, mathematical, scientific ideas, are just not there. Causality is not there. There's a lot more superstition. Although there's modern things going in there, like poltergeist. It's sort of like the worst trashy TV. go back then. And look, there's other translations which are worth having a stab at. And a lot of these things you miss if you just take the commercial channels for all these things. So that sort of ends my talk about schoolboy Latin, and I don't claim to be any Latin expert, and I believe that, more than thoroughly believe that, if you studied it for years on end, you would. I think there are experts in Latin. I'm just really thinking that you need a little bit of it to lever yourself through and actually wade through these texts and develop a more sophisticated understanding, more questioning understanding than the just repeating what's in textbooks. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.